Among the idyllic streets and rolling fields of America's heartland, something evil lurks in the shadows of these close-knit communities. I know because I grew up here and witnessed the fear these hauntings cause firsthand. Now, as a paranormal investigator and documentary filmmaker, I've made it my mission to travel the heartland and bring resolution to the living and the dead.
And with that introduction, welcome to another episode of the Necronomicast. My name is Brian Corey, and I am your host this evening. As I talk to the lead investigator of a new paranormal television show on the Travel Channel called Haunting in the Heartland. His name's Steve Shippey, and on the show, he visits Midwestern towns that have been traumatized for generations by ghosts and poltergeists and demons, causing ripples of fear, not only in the people's homes, but in the community as well. We're gonna be talking about his documentary films that he has on Amazon Prime and talking about his hip-hop career as the rapper known as Prozac. We might even talk a little bit about Tiger King. You never know what's going to happen here on the Necronomicast, so I invite you to sit back and relax as we talk to Steve Shippey on this episode coming up now. You know, we record this show from Omaha, Nebraska. My next guest is no stranger to things that are strange in the heartland. In fact, he's the host of Travel Channel's Haunting in the Heartland, Mr. Steve Shippey. How are you, sir?
Good. How you doing?
I'm doing great, man. I'm glad we were able to put this together, and I'm really excited to have a conversation with you. You've got a new show that just debuted. It just came out, the 6-episode season of Haunting in the Heartland. Real quick, because our time is limited, tell me about what got you into the paranormal, and then we'll start talking about the show.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, for me, the journey began in the paranormal growing up in my childhood home. The home was very haunted. We had a lot of malicious things happened. Didn't really start off that way, but it ended up that way. We would see shadowy figures in the home, anomalous force, things moving on their own, doors slamming. Eventually did get to where there was physical contact, pushing, scratching, stuff like that, and just got pretty nasty. So, I mean, growing up in an environment like that, it changes your perspective of everything, of course, because you're under a belief system, so to speak, that things are real, things are not real. And when you're turning to your parents saying, what is this? And, you know, at first they were trying to deny it was happening just out of what they thought was a way to kind of protect us kids. But then later on, when it got to the point where it was undeniable, they kind of had to come clean and say they don't know what it is. And that the conclusion was we needed to move and vacate the home. So that definitely led me down that path. Obviously, I think when you grow up in a situation like that, it kind of seems from other people I've spoke to that have been in those shoes, it either leaves you with a burning desire, I guess, so to speak, to find out more and to try to understand what it is and seek it. The answer is that is. And then for some people, it actually makes them want to run completely the other way and not even utter the word paranormal, basically.
Yeah, it seems like it's become a real life's mission with you. And, you know, watching the show, I've watched all 6 episodes. I checked out your documentaries and I've been reading about you. Growing up as a child with those experiences, I see watching this show, you had some interactions with a child, I think in the first episode. I just can't imagine what goes through your mind as you're investigating. You've been asked by the parents or the people that are in the home, own the home, to come and help with this paranormal situation. And then you see the reality of a child being there about the same age as you were when you were experiencing this. What was that like for you?
Well, you know, I mean, I definitely could identify with where she was coming from and how she felt having to actually vacate the house herself. You know, I mean, the dynamic of that episode, the Midcalf family, Adabel is the young girl you're talking about, and her father, Josh, yeah. vacated the home and fled the home and moved to Florida because the activity was so bad. So I could definitely identify with them and identify with them as a family as well, because they had told me that when the activity first began, it was quite a while before they all came together and discussed it as a family, because they were, you know, afraid to say anything. And some of the members of the family were experiencing things and at some weren't. And there was kind of a disbelief at different times. And I kind of think that's what these hauntings do. Quite frankly, it can separate a family. It can cause people to isolate, and it can ruin relationships. It's ruined marriages several times. I've seen that. Hauntings can be very powerful, not just in an anomalous way, but in a human way, what it can do to people.
Yeah, absolutely. I can't imagine the stress that's everything compounded with, you know, you're having, it affects everything, part of your life. It affects your job. It affects your, you know, relationship with your family, the people in the community and everything. And, you know, and then when you're doing this show, I've noticed that in the heartland with these closer, tight-knit communities, it really affects... You're really finding these cases that are affecting not just like the old house down on the corner. It seems to kind of infiltrate and sneak its way and creep its way into the psyche of the community.
Right. Yeah, you're absolutely right about that. I mean, we were seeking out these type of cases for haunting in the heartland. You know, when we were creating, if you will, I guess the model, so to speak, of the show, you know, trying to figure out what our mission was, I wanted to continue doing pretty much what I do with my own series, Haunted Saginaw, that is on Amazon Prime. I wanted to continue investigating the way that I do, but we decided to broaden the scope, of course, not just in my region here, but actually traveling further around the Midwest, which is where I feel most comfortable, the Heartland region. And we wanted to make sure that with Haunting in the Heartland, the stipulations that we felt were important is we want to make sure that we're actually helping families and people, not just investigating abandoned buildings or, you know, old asylums or whatever it may be. And that we were looking for more community-based hauntings to try to figure out why there's so many of these very strange cases where it seems like an entire town is affected. And of course, you know, for the people that have seen some of the episodes or studied cases like this, you'll often be able to trace back through lots of research that there's been some type of tragedy or something that has left its imprint or residue on the community.
You know, I got a sense of that firsthand. We went and stayed at the Sally House, which was featured a little bit on your one of your episodes of this show on the Travel Channel, and spending the night in the Sally House and watching you kind of walk through and everything too. And I've seen other documentaries and read about the Sally House. People in that community, Atchison, it's a real close knit community, but you can feel it as soon as you drive into that town. There's stories. They have all kinds of stories about that town. And one of the best parts of actually going to the Sally House was listening to stories of the town and the history of the town and the history of the house from the tour guide, because you can tell the local guy had the whole dish on the whole place, the whole town. And it was so fascinating and interesting to hear about that. So I really appreciate you saying about focusing on the community, because a lot of times that's lost. You'll watch these shows and it's a guy with a flashlight in one building, and then the next episode he's just someplace else. They're just investigating just to investigate. This, you're actually getting community history, and it's really very interesting. It's a different way to do it.
Yeah, you know, you're right about Atchison. I mean, you know what's really interesting to me about Atchison, Kansas, is it really reminds me of my city here, Saginaw, Michigan. I mean, obviously there's differences, of course, but there's a very similar vibe. The amount of hauntings, the amount of people that witness things, the whole town likes to talk about it. And there's a story on every block, basically. So, and kind of similar in size as well, but it was very interesting to go there, boots on the ground, talking to people, talking to Maria there, who's an expert in the community, and telling me about the Sally House. And, you know, of course, when you're doing a television show, when they cut it down, I mean, we were there for, I think, 7 days, about 12 to 14 hours per day. And then it all goes into 42 and a half minutes. But we spent probably 8 hours in the Sally house, and some pretty extraordinary things happened in that house that never made the episode. And I definitely believe the hype about the Sally house after experiencing it.
Yeah. We spent the night there, and we were growled at. We were growled at for sure.
Yeah. So yeah, we were too. In fact, you know, the reason I was there is because literally the Airbnb I was staying in was like a half a block from the Sally house.
Oh, sure.
It was right there across the street, you know, and we thought, you know, maybe there could be a connection, because it seemed that no matter where we went, when we talked about hauntings and the community, everybody without fail would bring up the Sally house. So we thought, well, let's turn over this stone and check it out. And definitely were growled at. The faucets were turned on, both in the bathroom and the kitchen. And what's interesting is I talked to another paranormal investigator, Josh Hurd from Iowa, and he was telling me that story, and I didn't even share with him our experience. And he was talking about how they were there for about 10 minutes and both of the faucets came on. And I just thought that was super interesting.
Oh yeah. Shout out to Josh Hurd. He's a former guest on our show, being down the road, so to speak, in Iowa. He's a real friend of the program. So, and he's a stand-up guy.
He is.
When he tells you something, you know, he's not embellishing or giving you a line of bullshit. You know, he's a good guy.
I worked with him. His brother was having a really bad situation. It was our season finale for Haunting in the Heartland. And it was pretty interesting that, as you know, we were there to help a family, and that, James, the gentleman that was being oppressed by a demonic force, his brother was, you know, Josh was a paranormal investigator. So we just thought that was an interesting dynamic. And, that's how I met him. And, you know, we worked really well together investigating, and I actually featured him in my upcoming documentary, Haunting on Brockway Street 2, which comes out in the fall.
Oh, exciting. Yeah, I wanted to talk to you about your documentaries. Now, these are all available, all of them, I assume. I know there's a slew of them. They're on Amazon Prime.
Yeah. I have 10 full-length paranormal investigation documentaries on Amazon Prime right now. And for people that are listening to this too, if they didn't get a chance to see Haunting in the Heartland, that's actually available on Amazon Prime as well, the whole season. So all of my content is there.
Yeah, that's great. And when you're stuck at home, it's a great show to watch. Everybody's talking about this Tiger King thing, and I watched that. And that was pretty interesting.
I was guilty of it too. I mean, after seeing a zillion memes, I'm like, okay, yeah. You know, I won't go into it too much to waste your time with this story. But what's funny is I got a really good friend out in Iowa, Cedar Falls. And about 4 years ago, well, maybe longer than that, maybe about 5 years ago, he called me and he said, man, I got to tell you something right now. I'm like, what's up? He's like, so we get off our tour bus and we stop at this place, and he's describing all this like insanity, you know, tigers and this and that. And there's a guy that's like wrestling with a tiger out front, and we go in the store and every item in the store has his face on it. And, you know, he's talking about underwear and beef jerky. And I'm like, what are you talking about? He's like, yeah. And he's got two husbands and this and that. And I'm like, what is this? You know, where did you go? I mean, is it like a show or something? He's like, no, it's like a store. And I'm like, and he tells me his name is Joe Exotic. And then he said, oh, and did I mention he's also a country music singer, has music videos.
Yeah, by the way.
Yeah. So my friend Judd was obsessed with sending me constant, you know, music videos of this guy. And then a few weeks ago, he hit me up and he's like, I told you this guy was going to be famous one day. And then I realized what it was. So I had to watch the Tiger King. And yeah, it was a train wreck, but I kept watching. I'm not going to lie. I just had to keep going. I got sucked into it.
Oh, I know, man. Well,
did you see the new episode? I haven't yet.
No, I haven't. I got to check that out. Now, when people are done watching that stuff, they need to go and find your show. I have YouTube TV. And so right under Travel Channel, all the episodes are there. If you haven't caught it already, or if you have watched them, you should watch them again, you know, kind of go through them like I did, because I picked up much more on the second viewing. It's good for repeat viewings, you know.
Yeah.
In addition, I assume you got this sweet gig at Travel Channel because of your work with your documentaries. Now, you make those yourself.
Yes. Yep. I do. So yeah, that's basically what happened. I was contacted by a production company out of LA. I was being contacted actually quite a bit for about 6 months continuously, which that kind of told me that the tide had changed and that for some reason there was a slew of companies looking for paranormal content. Because I was, you know, it was just left and right, I had this happening. But what caught my eye was the gentleman that contacted me. I researched him, and he has done a lot of very notable things, held some pretty high positions at different networks, and now has his own company. And when I found out it was Travel, I was very interested, because to me that would be the one network that I would have been willing to do a show with, you know. And so I was interested in that, and once I kind of got involved in the deal and started talking about it and found out that Travel was basically like, we want you to do what you do, and we don't want to change that. We would like to help you broaden your scope and go out a little bit further around the country. And it felt good. You know, it felt right. And it turned out to be a great thing.
Yeah, it seems like a good fit, because I just watched one of your documentaries. I heard you on another interview talking about this haunting on Dice Road. And you made a documentary, I guess you made two, about the experiences at this place on Dice Road. And I was watching it and I was like, wow, I wonder how much it seems like you didn't have to change your style at all from your self-produced documentaries, which are very good, to this broadcast TV quality show. It seems like you're still doing your investigations your way.
Yes. Yeah, it's definitely that way. The only thing that has changed, you know, I guess from what I do with Haunted Saginaw versus Haunting in the Heartland is time. You know, so when I film these documentaries, in fact, I'm sure Josh Hurd will tell you we're pretty insane, man. We're there for months. You know, of course, Josh was just there for a few days, but I stay in a location for about an average of 90 days. You know, trying to collect as much evidence as possible, leaving cameras run 24/7 and just really going all in. And of course, with Haunting in the Heartland, it was more about a week to 10 days per investigation.
Now, when you're making your documentary, and you have a lot of them, and I only got to see so far Haunting on Dice Road, which it was really incredible. I want to say the amount of footage that you had, because sometimes you watch the shows and you think, well, the evidence is the payoff. Well, the story was the real star of the show. I mean, you had some incredible evidence. We'll get to that. But you interviewed police officers, former police officers, retired police officers, people that had jobs of high responsibility in the community.
Yes.
Friends, neighbors, family members, all in this house on Dice Road, which is it in Saginaw? Is that what you said?
Yeah, Saginaw County. But the small town is called Merrill.
That's right.
Yeah.
So you have the evidence is one thing, but when you have police photocopies of police report after police report after police report and interview after interview with all these cops, police officers, neighbors, family, It was a documentary that I wasn't, I don't know what I was expecting, but what we got out of it was incredible. I mean, it really, some of that footage is really breathtaking.
Well, let me say this. First of all, thank you for saying that, because, you know, out of all the cases I've done in my life, out of all the investigations, that particular case is on my mind at all times. And what you see, honestly, even though it was pretty mind-blowing what you saw in terms of how many cops, how many law enforcement agencies, stakeouts, task force assigned to it, polygraphs, explosions, fires, universities, a year. I mean, it is insane. And that's only the tip of the iceberg. Only so much was able to make the film. There's so many fascinating things about that. I mean, even to the point where when law enforcement finally gave up because they exhausted a year straight of incredible resource and manpower, the owner of the Detroit Tigers, John Fetzer, actually took $50,000 of his money. Now think about that amount of money in 1975.
Yeah.
To help fund the research. And in fact, a book recently came out. It's actually right next to me on my desk here about John Fetzer. A little known fact, John Fetzer was actually obsessed with the occult and actually used to use spirits and tarot cards spirit boards and tarot cards to make business decisions and things of that nature. He was a very eccentric millionaire, very obsessed with the occult. And because he was interested in things like this, he would privately fund paranormal research teams, such as the one from Duke University that came out to study the phenomenon. And in fact, since you just happened to watch it, let me tell you this. I was able about 2 weeks ago to locate all the original reel-to-reel recordings that the university recorded in that house in 1975. They still exist, and I've been able to track them down.
Oh my gosh. Well, be careful with that magnetic tape. That's got to be taken care of and digitally preserved. Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Well, they're actually archived, and it's an extremely hefty price tag. But if I want to get copies, of course, I don't touch it. It goes to a certain company that they feel will handle it properly, and then I'll be able to receive a copy of it. Yeah.
Amazing. Now, you said that was that the general manager of the Detroit Tigers? Spent 50.
He was the owner of the Detroit Tigers. His name was John Fetzer.
And he was into the occult, huh?
Yeah, he was super into the occult. In fact, if you just Google John Fetzer occult or John Fetzer Ouija board, an article will pop up in the Detroit Free Press talking about the professor here in Michigan that just wrote that big book about him.
That sounds interesting. I'll have to go back and check their draft.
And his name,
their drafts.
His name is in all these police reports too. By the way, it's not just. And you know, what's interesting is it's not even in that book. I don't even think the author knew that he was involved in this particular case, but John Fetzer's name is in at least a dozen of these police reports.
I wonder if he used the Ouija board when he was doing like drafting of players and if it helped him get like into the pennant race or anything like that. I'll have to check and see their record.
Yeah. when you read that article, it actually says that he used that to make business decisions. And I think even pick players and whatnot.
Wow.
Yeah. You'll have to check out the article and possibly the book.
My God, I totally will have to check that out. That sounds incredible.
And so that's just one of those things that are not in the film. And there's probably a couple of dozen, you know, shockers that never even made it in there.
Now you have a sequel too to that one.
Yes. In fact, you know, it's funny that you brought that up because I was going to, you know, bring it up earlier when you asked me about that case with the Midcalf family and asking me, you know, how I felt when I seen the young girl going through the tragedy. When you watch Dice 2, that's actually the original investigation I did with that family. When I got the show Haunting in the Heartland, they allowed me to revisit one of my cases, but because of the fact that they said, pretty much the production company had told me that, you know, you got to look at it to where the majority of people that are going to watch this show haven't seen your films, and it might be complicated to keep referencing your movie, your documentary. So I basically, you know, met these people on camera for the first time, so to speak. It was a little bit awkward for me, but I understood it made sense.
Yeah.
Now, if you watch A Haunting on Dice Road 2, that will really give you the gravity of that case.
Yeah. That's probably the next thing I'll watch. After I get off the phone with you, with your show, how do you select these cases? Because obviously, you know, were people contacting you? Do they contact you for investigations, and then you just kind of keep track of them? Because you got greenlit for a show, and then I assume you started filming the show. So, but you had to have the cases beforehand. Do people contact you?
So basically, how that went down is, you know, I've got a pretty large amount of people in my social media network that I, you know, that I was referencing. I get a lot of messages from people around the country that are telling me that they're having issues. Some of them came from there. And also one of our producers on the show, Katie Berry, she spent many years producing the show A Haunting.
Oh.
And so she has quite a Rolodex of paranormal investigators in her network, and she was also fielding out some of them to say, hey, do you guys have any urgent cases that are 100% valid, that people need help, that there's affecting a community? And she was able to definitely help out quite a bit with that. So it was kind of a collective.
That's interesting. So you're, are you moving forward? It's probably too soon to say if you're moving forward with season two, but if season two does get greenlit, do you have places that you're going to go? Do you have some things in mind?
You know, definitely. I was already semi-flooded with requests before, but of course, after Haunting of the Heartland came out, that's increased quite a bit. And I've saved a lot of those requests, and I've been in correspondence with those people. So if it were to be greenlit, we could operate right away. I haven't heard definitively one way or the other, but I've recently found out that perhaps it's looking promising that we'll move forward, but nothing concrete.
Yeah. Well, my best to you. The show is fantastic. I hope it gets greenlit. I'd like to see a lot more of these places, because living in Omaha, like the middle of the country, we go investigate. You know, we've done the Villisca House, we've done the Millard Malvern Manor, we've done the Farrar Schoolhouse, the Sally House, the Beatty Mansion. So we've done like the landmark kind of places. But I think it's always interesting to see like these private residences and these real human stories that you uncover and that you try and help. When you're doing these things, with the time that we have remaining, and then I want to talk.
Yeah, I didn't want to interrupt you on that, but I just literally gained about 12 minutes. If you want to use them.
Oh, great. Yeah, sure. Yeah. Okay. We'll just keep rock and roll.
Literally, someone just texted me and said, hey, I'm going to be a little bit late getting to the studio. So I'm like, all right, cool.
Nice, man. So yeah, I'm keeping a strict eye on the time for you. So, so when you're doing these shows, let's see, where was my train of thought? Oh yeah. Because these shows that you're doing, families and people and everything, how are you feeling, you know, like afterwards, like how do you deal with the stress as a paranormal investigator, as a guy that's hearing all these heavy stories, not just about spooks and specters and ghosts, but these stories about it's affecting me this way. I can't sleep at night. I am stressed. I'm getting an ulcer. I'm scared for the safety of my family. How do you take those stories and what do you do to decompress, like at the end of a session or a season?
Okay. Well, that's a great question. And I'm probably going to give you an answer that you're not going to expect maybe. So one thing I noticed that a lot of people say when they watch Haunting in the Heartland, I read a lot of the reviews and the comments. A lot of people say they really appreciate how calm and how my demeanor is while I'm doing these cases. And the reason for that is because I feel calm while I'm there, because I feel like I'm going to help them. I've been through what they've gone through. Of course, I'm definitely empathizing with them, and I'm feeling their emotions, and it does hurt at times, or it does, you know, you do feel really bad for them. But I don't let that overwhelm me, because I know that before I leave that home, I'm going to educate them the best I can on what they're dealing with, that they're not alone, that this happens to so many people, that I personally have been through it. You don't see that, of course, on the video, but because I don't necessarily want it to be. But with each one of these cases, I go out of my way to tell them what's happened to me, mm-hmm. and how I understand what they're going through. And we kind of have our own private talk for sometimes a few hours. So I get right on base with them and let them know, listen, first of all, you're not alone. You're not crazy. You should not feel embarrassed. This is a big deal. This is a real thing, but we're going to help you with this. We're going to empower you with knowledge about it. And we're going to do everything we can to leave you guys in a better way than how we found you. If that makes sense, I kind of know that going into it, that no matter what, we're going to help them in many ways, or at least enough of a way to make it a better situation for them.
Yeah, I respect.
You know, so,
sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, you got total empathy. You can sense coming through the screen when dealing with these people. And you're right, man. Sharing your experiences that you have in common, it's going to build a trust. You know, it's going
to
build.
Yeah, definitely. And that's why I try to remain as calm as I can, is because I feel that if I can hold that demeanor while dealing with the families and everybody, I feel like it helps to calm them down. Because, you know, if I get overly excited about something or have a knee-jerk reaction when they say something, and then they'll think, oh, God, well, maybe it's worse than I thought. Did you see the way he reacted when I told him what happened last week? You know, so I just make them feel very comfortable that no matter what they tell me, I'm not going to be shocked by it. And I'm going to let them know that, you know, it is okay. We will get it figured out, you know?
Sure. You know, I've been interested in the paranormal since I was a kid, and I'm 45 now. I don't know how old you are, but you
42.
Oh, yeah, and you were interested in a lot different reason than I was. You know, you're experiencing it firsthand. Have your thoughts about what all this is. Has it changed and evolved over the years? You know what I mean? Sometimes I don't yes. even know. I don't even know what a ghost is nowadays. You know what I mean?
I know. No, believe me, I totally agree with you. I mean, I've been through many different wormholes. So that's actually, to me, it's a very complex question. But the way that I would kind of answer that is, I do feel that, you know, of course, even though there's nothing concrete when it comes to paranormal, right? This is all theory.
Yeah.
But I do really believe that there are some things that I truly believe we can count on. I do believe that residual activity is just that. I think we have a good grasp on certain things. Certain things I do not. And let me tell you the one that absolutely plagues me, right?
Yeah.
Poltergeist.
Mm.
That term gets used. And for some reason lately, it's making a huge comeback. You keep hearing about a poltergeist. So many different theories on what it is, whether it's a human phenomenon. Some people believe it's actually some type of deity, some type of spirit that's summoned, that's conjured. Some people believe it can be both. Some people think it's like the movie and it's a manifestation or infestation of multiple spirits. I'm very confused by that in general. Me personally, I tend to believe that a poltergeist truly is a human phenomenon. Although, I can't say that definitively because some aspects about paranormal phenomenon just don't add up to the theory. Poltergeist phenomenon. Sorry.
Yeah. When you say it's more human, are you saying like the theory about like an adolescent kid in the house and they charge up the atmosphere with energy, that kind of thing? Or
yeah, you know, and I think that it's usually definitely an adolescent that, you know, that's kind of the stereotypical case. But of course, you know, they have found it with adults and yeah. and both genders and whatnot. But I do think that it's a strange, very rare occurrence that has to do with an individual or even the dynamic of a group of individuals that causes some type of toxic environment mm-hmm. emotionally. And I just think it's a very rare thing to find a actual true poltergeist case. And I think that sometimes poltergeist case will be misdiagnosed and it's actually an intelligent haunting and something different. I think it's a very gray area, I guess, of the paranormal world. But then a broader answer to your question, I feel that it's very hard sometimes to discern the opinion on, you know, what are some of these things that we're dealing with? Are the inhuman realm, the demonic realm? You know, there are so many different factions of what is happening out there. But how do you truly know what you are communicating with? And what it is and what it isn't. Of course, we're not going to have the answers until, well, you know.
Yeah, that's right. We're not going to have the answers until, you know, right? That's right. That's what's so intriguing and important about, like, these investigations. A lot of people, you know, think, you know, it's entertainment or things like that on TV. But, you know, the people that are really honestly doing paranormal research that's outside the box, you know, it's going to answer someday, hopefully, maybe not, probably not, an age-old question. Why, you know, why are we here? Why, what's going to happen after this? You know, it's not like we're always chasing,
yes.
you know, and I don't always think it's always like paranormal. Like people say, well, aren't you scared of ghosts when you go to these places? And I'm like, well, I guess. I mean, I don't know what I'm up against, you know, and I'm just going there for the experience of seeing if there's anything to experience.
You know, to your point right there, there's I don't know who originally, you know, coined this this phrase, but I find it to be very true. And they say that, you know, the two questions that kind of drive the mankind that kind of plagues our mind. Are we alone in the universe? And what happens when we die?
Yeah.
You know, and I think it really does kind of come down to that. Those are the two things I think that we all long for the answers. You know, of course we want the answers. I mean, number one, it's our destiny, death. And, you know, we are experiencing so many things. So many millions of people throughout recorded history have experienced encounters with the paranormal. And, you know, I think those things are always going to plague us.
Yeah. Does anything else out there interest you in the paranormal world, like another tentacle in the octopus, like Bigfoot? You ever dip your toe into that?
You know, actually, no. I mean, don't get me wrong. I've definitely watched a lot of documentaries about Bigfoot,
right.
The old Art Bell shows, and you know, and anything that I consume. I am a paranormal junkie. I'm not. I mean, I will watch it all, from the Jersey Devil to aliens to doppelgangers. You name it. I have an open mind to, you know, to look into it. You know, UFOs, aliens definitely interest me, of course, because as we're finding out that space is so much larger than we had ever imagined before, the amount of planets that we now know to exist. And if we know that to exist now, how much more is there to discover? To think that we are the only life in something that infinite is, to me, is just completely an ignorant thing, you know? But what is out there? What type of intelligence is out there? Do we have anything to fear? Do we have anything to gain? Is there any mutual benefit? Who knows?
Yeah, man, because somebody was mentioning me the other day, well, what if Bigfoot, it's really just the ghosts of the Neanderthals? And I'm like, holy Jesus, I didn't even...
Yeah, somebody dropped that on me once, too, and I was kind of like, thanks. I already have, you know, insomnia. That's going to just hit me at some random time, you know? Somebody hit me with this the other day, actually, my niece.
Yeah.
Me and my niece were on the phone trying to, like, get through the quarantine, just, you know, cracking jokes on each other or whatever. And she's like, you want to know something really weird? You've never seen your face. And I just looked at her on FaceTime. I'm like, what? You've never seen your face. None of us have. We've only seen reflections of our face.
Wow. How old is that kid?
I think, well, see, now you're putting me on the spot. She's going to hear this and be like, jerk. I think she's 22 now.
Oh, yeah. There's some insight there.
She said that, I was like, yeah, thanks. I needed to hear that, you know, right now as I'm sequestered in my, you know, time here in lockdown in the state of Michigan during the Corona COVID fun, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, but honestly though, that's a very just, you know, crazy thought. You know what I mean? It's like, yeah, I guess none of us will ever be able to see our face, you know, literally.
And that's why we're the scholars of the strange. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Before I let you go, growing up in the 80s and 90s, hip hop was really, really influential to me. And I was like a music major in college. And we listened to a ton of hip hop when it was coming up. And being in the Midwest, we were hit by East Coast, West Coast, the South stuff pretty hard. And you, mm-hmm. And I bring this up because you are an accomplished rapper, hip hop artist by the name of Prozac.
Yes.
That's I just think that's great, man. I was listening to some of your beats and some of your music over the last couple of days, and you've got a great flow, man. What were you listening to? What are some of your hip hop, you know, influences or like idols?
Well, I mean, you know, I grew up in an era where, of course, you know, you had your Ice Cubes and your Dr. Dre's and your NWA's and all that stuff, and you know, I listened to quite a bit of different things, but you know, to be real honest with you, it's kind of interesting that I ever even got into hip hop, because growing up I was a very big metalhead and still am. That's basically 90% of my catalog is, you know, Sepultura, Pantera, of course, Black Sabbath, Slayer. I could go on infinitely with that.
Yeah.
And yeah, you know, so you know, pretty much I pretty much consumed all things hip hop. And, you know, from the obscure to the mainstream. And I've definitely played many times in Omaha. In fact, my record label's in Kansas City, Missouri, Strange Music.
Oh, wow.
I'm sure you're familiar with Tech N9ne.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah, so I've been signed with him since 2002.
Yeah.
Worked with a lot of artists I'm sure you probably know. I've done songs with Cypress Hill and Bizarre from D12 and Twista and... toured with pretty much everybody at some point or another.
That's fantastic, man. And we'll keep it up, because I was listening. I was like, man, you know, you got flow. It's there, man. I can hear it. It's great.
Thank you. Yeah. And I've, you know, tried to tie the two in together. In fact, my biggest album was titled Paranormal, actually.
Oh, okay. Great. Well, I'll totally give that a spin, and I invite everybody else to as well. We had the pleasure to talk to Steve Shippey. Steve is the host of Haunting in the Heartland on the Travel Channel. You can watch that now. You can also go to Amazon Prime if you're a member there, or however you stream your stuff through Amazon. He's got his documentaries. He's got his music. And he's a hustler, man. You work hard. I mean, lining this up, I hate to be a bother, but I'm like, you know, I got to do my grind, and I respect yours, man. You work hard.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I'm very glad I was able to link up with you. I've done a remarkable amount of interviews and podcasts within the last few months as a result of the Travel Channel show. And honest to God, you're one of the favorite people I've spoken to. So anytime you ever want to, have me on, or even perhaps I'll have you on my podcast, the invitation is always there. It's actually been really great doing this.
Well, that's great, man. Yeah, much love to you. I'll be following your career. I'll be following you. If you ever come through the Nebraska area, Children of the Corn, that's us.
Oh, yeah, we definitely will, man. I feel like during the time that we filmed Haunting in the Heartland, we'd gone through Nebraska, I think, 3 or 4 times, actually, while we were there. So,
yeah, shit's spooky here for real.
Yeah. Oh, it definitely is. Yeah. I've got a lot of friends in that area. So in fact, when I called in and I saw your area code, I was like, yep, I know exactly where you are.
Yeah. Well, that's great, man. Well, listen, we'll stay in touch, and thanks for everything. I've really had a great conversation with you, like a great time just sitting back and listening to somebody that, a lot of times people with these paranormal things, they just slap on a crew slaps on a matching shirt and they hold a recorder and they don't know what they're doing. But to see somebody out there really do a true investigation, looking for the facts, trying to uncover truth, it was refreshing to see, and it's been refreshing talking to you. Thanks a lot, Steve.
Yeah. One thing before you go, man, let me just put this invitation out there to you if you would like to attend. But we do a really big red carpet premiere every year. When we put out a film, we have 4,000 people that attend. We've been doing it for 10 years continuously at the Temple Theater here in Saginaw. That my new documentary that comes out that Josh Hurd was in, if you want to come up to the premiere, let me know. I'll take care of you. I'll take care of your lodging, everything, and let you come check it out, and maybe we can do an episode together in person and just come see what I do.
Yeah, let's do it. Absolutely. Okay. That sounds fantastic. I'll be in touch. We know how to get a hold of each other. And yep. Once again, great talking to you, and just keep up the good work and stay safe, man. Please.
All right. You too. Thank you.
All right. God bless you.
All right. You too. Bye.
Bye. You have been listening to another episode of the Necronomicast. As always, produced and recorded right here in Omaha, Nebraska. We've been doing the show for the past 10 years out of Omaha. Had different hosts, different formats, different ways to present ideas to you. And we're going to change up again. That's right. Sorry. That was Mr. Andrew Vogt on saxophone. Still is. Friend of the program. Yeah, so we're going to be changing formats. I know for the past couple years you've enjoyed the group dynamic of exploring the different things about Hollywood and the scary movies and all that. But going forward right now, it's just going to be me rocking the mic. Do people even say rocking the mic anymore? I don't know. But it's going to be an interview-based show, a conversation. Not confrontational, conversational. We're going to be talking to people in Hollywood. We're going to be talking people that see life and the world around us a little bit differently. A little offbeat, a little strange, but that's good. Variety is the spice of life. Am I right? So keep listening. The Necronomicast. This episode, copyright 2020.